there and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb Keith and I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco as we continue to do the Why You Should series. The Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our episodes. And of course, 1517 is more than podcasts. And this week that we recorded this is an excellent reminder of that because we are sitting here at the place that my family is staying at in Bentonville, Arkansas, where we just had our Here We Still Stand regional event, one of our two annual conferences. If you saw us in Bentonville, it was great to have you here. If you weren't able to make it, maybe you'll meet us at our national event in October, or maybe you can look at Bentonville for next year. It was truly an awesome time, I thought. It's, you know, an evening and a day of speaking and hanging out, and it's really quite enjoyable. This is a smaller venue here in Bentonville. We can do about 175 people, so when tickets go on sale for that, sooner than later is usually your opportunity to get in. But the national conference, Dad, how many spots are we selling for that this year?
500.
So, and if you can make it, if you can make it down to sunny Southern California in October, it's an awesome conference, and it's longer than this one. This one's, you know,
a night and a day.
I've been to a lot of conferences in my life, probably you too, Scott.
More than I'd like to remember.
And the one in San Diego in October, 1517, is by far the best.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing else compares.
Yeah. Not even this. This is a great conference. But the one in October is really conference/celebration.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. As like a one-day-ish conference, this has got to be, this one in Bentonville has got to be one of the best setup ones ever, because if you can't take a whole week off to do something like this, and not everybody can, it's awesome because things don't start until the late afternoon, so you could fly the day of.
Or drive. People do.
So that's on Friday, and it starts Friday evening, like pretty late, so you could have a drive, you could have a flight, and then it ends Saturday at around 2-ish, 2:30-ish, which means a lot of people can fly back, including pastors who have to preach the next day and people
as long as there's not weather.
Want to be home. As long as there's not weather, you know, it's an amazing little setup because I feel like we are able to pack so much into that small period of time. It doesn't feel like a small conference, even though you could come in Friday night and you could leave Saturday afternoon.
Yeah. Was it six or seven speech or talks in less than 24 hours?
Seven. Yeah.
Yeah.
At about 25-ish to 35-ish minutes each.
Yeah. So it was great.
I think I went the longest.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
I think so.
You did too.
Well, you're the closer. You get to do what you want. There's nobody coming after you that you have to wrap up for.
Yep.
Just so everybody knows, we're recording kind of old school. I know that when we do these episodes, it sounds like Adam's in the room. Usually, right? Because we've got this fancy little recording box that does some magic for us. But this time, Adam is actually in the room.
Unless he messes something up.
And then we're going to kick him out of the room?
No, when you're recording at your own office, it sounds like you're in the room unless you mess something up.
Oh, yeah. He's done a good job. Adam's done a good job with the box.
Yeah.
I do what I'm told. Push the right buttons.
We're in an Airbnb. There's dogs around. There's kids around, so if you hear some background noise, that's what this is. So, well, guys, the Here We Still Stand conferences, especially as you mentioned, the one in San Diego, was originally set up as a celebration of the Reformation, and the conference themes throughout have picked up some piece, some motto, some event inside of the Reformation as their theme and as the thing we gather around. And so maybe following this conference and as we do this Why You Should series, which is sort of circling through topics that we've done in the past and looking at them through a new question, a new setup, I thought maybe we would do an episode that is something like why you should study the Reformation, or maybe studies too formal and do why you should know something about the Reformation. And we obviously have a good chunk of Lutheran listeners, but in addition to that, I mean, we have other people in the Reformation tradition. We have lay people. We have people who maybe don't know much about the Reformation, as 1517 is getting some exposure through some of our podcasts on the Bible app, the YouVersion Bible app, and the like, and maybe some of the ads we ran, say, on National Review. I know I've had listeners reach out to us who came from the National Review podcast network and are now listening to some 1517 shows. Why should those people, I mean, why should, let's say, Lutheran laity, other Reformed laity, and then maybe somebody who doesn't know anything about the Reformation, actually take any time out of their day to know something about the Reformation, learn about the Reformation in any capacity? That's a big question today.
But, well, I'll answer in a very broad and general way. In many ways, the Reformation, along with the Renaissance and things that happened after it, laid the foundation for the modern world.
Yeah, the modern West, at least.
Yeah, yeah, certainly the modern West. A lot of the things that made, you know, the particulars of Western civilization come from the Reformation. I think Rod Rosenblatt would always say, like, behind the doctrine of justification, or alongside of it maybe, the doctrine of vocation is probably the most far-reaching thing or idea that comes out of the Reformation. But let me backtrack a little bit here, too. We probably ought to say what the Reformation is, what we're referring to.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good place to start with these questions.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking like 1500s. We're talking not just Northern Germany and not just Martin Luther, but we're talking a movement that stretched across the continent of Europe that's multifaceted. There are Lutherans. There are various reform type of reformations that take place. There are kind of the modern, or the, you know, the early modern version of Pentecostals and the Anabaptist movement and sectarians, and basically all, you know, the, on one hand, the breakdown of Western Christendom, you know, like Roman Christendom, takes place at the very beginning of the Reformation. But on the other hand, all sorts of new, if you will, opportunities to re-envision Christianity or realign Christianity such that it falls square with the teachings of the Bible all of a sudden become possible as a result of Luther standing up at Worms and saying, I'm not gonna recant.
Right.
I think the mention of, like, that it's a disturbance for this unit we called Christendom, where the practice of the church, theology, Christian practice is so married with political life, princes, where borders are drawn, all sorts of things, that the Reformation, even if you're not a student of theology, is a massive and significant point in human history and the development of politics and the changing of borders and the changing of power in Europe. And you can trace the effects of what happens during the Reformation with the various princes, various exiles, to conflicts as late as the World Wars, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You can, you know, sometimes historians will ask counterfactual type questions to assess the importance of an individual or an event. And so you could say, what if Luther didn't write the 95 Theses? Or what if Luther was never born? What would our world be like? And our world probably looked very differently than it does now, had there not been somebody like Luther.
Had there not been Luther, perhaps, because there were people like Luther before Luther.
Sure.
I think it's enough to say if there had not been Luther, the world would be very different.
Yeah. I mean, there could have been somebody like a Luther later, and we might arrive at where we are now later on. It's all very speculative,
right? Could we be 100 years behind in just the course of human history today had it taken another individual?
I love these type of questions, personally. Yeah. Like, if Rome had not fallen, when would we have gone to space?
We do a lot of this with...
much earlier, you know, I think.
Talking about You know, like the common one for my generation, there's, I think, some video games, some books. I don't know. There was a TV show maybe based on this as well, Man in the High Castle, where it's always like, what if the Nazis won?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Those right? I love those.
I want somebody to do.
Although that one ended weird.
I want somebody to do like a Netflix, you know, long series TV show that's like, what if Luther didn't reform?
That's a really great.
That'd be
idea.
Like a cool history one, and then like make up.
You should
some
not
character.
Publish this podcast and write that down.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. Or take it out. Take that little section out.
So, I think about this kind of thing quite often, and I'm able to play a little bit more fast and loose with like history, because I'm not a historian.
Does that mean Adam gets to play fast and loose with theology on the show?
Indeed.
Indeed, yeah. But the I think it's very important for people to know just how different the world was prior to Luther in terms of sources of power and authority. In other words, sometimes when I teach this, you know, and I'm teaching to laymen, and so, like I said, a fast and loose maybe isn't accurate, but I'm not super careful with like the details of what I'm saying, but I think it's important for lay people to know that. And again, this is how I would normally say it. If you had a question about something prior to the Reformation that was outside of your trained sort of craft, right? So let's say you're
expertise.
Say you're a dude. Your job is a mason, right? So you would have, when you were, what, 12 or 13, apprenticed with an older mason for probably 6 to 7 years. And in your early 20s, you would have been gone on to your own masonry craft, right? But that right there is what you knew. That's what you knew. You knew masonry. You probably knew you knew some basic hygiene, basic math in order to like get paid for your masonry work and buy chickens and whatnot to feed your family. But that's what you knew. If you had a question about something bigger, like how do I get the king to X? How do I get God to let me into heaven? Da, da, da. You were likely going to ask your local priest that question. Mm-hmm. And I think with this, you can think of almost anything that is, that we would these days call sort of ethereal, philosophical, theological, political. You're going to ask your local authority, and your closest local authority, whose name you know is likely your priest. And that's who you're going to for this stuff, right? The education, like specifically when we talk about the Reformation sort of, and Adam refers to like the Holy Roman Empire, you're talking about, you know, a section of land, what, from like mid-northern Italy, kind of swooping out a little towards France and kind of up into northern Germany, mm-hmm. right, and around. So if you can kind of think of like the EU-ish, save for some.
Yeah. France like, is independent, you know, their own kingdom.
And save for France, but you're kind of talking like EU-ish, right? The reality is that you're... There's not like a education system,
right?
You might be educated. Chances are you might not.
And that would include, if I can butt in for a second, the priest you're going to ask the question.
Yeah, that includes the priest.
might not even be literate.
Right.
I mean, in many ways, you know, the phrase hocus pocus, that comes from a priest who had memorized the Latin, but not
really
well.
Memorize it, yeah.
And when he's up there doing the words of institution, hocus corpus meum, you know, he's maybe saying hocus pocus, or the people behind him are hearing that.
Hocus,
you know,
pocus, yeah.
So he might know a lot. He might know. Might not know
you
anything.
Could have a very educated. Yeah,
this is a roll of the dice, right? People that are going to go on to be lawyers will get some education. I mean, it's kind of how Luther got
people
to start.
Talking in court. Yeah.
People are talking court. They're advocates, that type of thing. But other than that, there's not really a lot of. It's not perceived as a lot of use for it. I mean, if you're a lay person and you want to study the Bible, why learn to read when they're not going to let you see the Bible, right? And
not only that, but you'd have to read in Latin,
right? Yeah. Not only your own language, German or French or whatever, but you'd have to learn Latin because they're not translating it. And so that lack of education and that fact that the sort of kind of universal focus of power that held on after the fall of the Roman Empire was the Holy Roman Catholic Church, really meant that you had little power, especially in the Holy Roman Empire, like kingdoms. But the central power was going to always be the church. And this means like authority too, for asking questions and answering questions, and at that time having a lot of political authority too. One of the things, if you don't care about theology, knowing a little bit about the Reformation will tell you a little about even how we got to the political systems that we operate under, the educational systems that we utilize to educate not just our little children, but our middle school children and our high school children and universities.
You guys like Neil Postman, right?
I do,
ish.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you do ish?
I said, did I say ish?
I think so.
Oh, weird.
Oh, yeah. I said ish.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was like, I didn't think I said ish, but I did hear it, and it could have been me.
I read another one of his books. This one was The Disappearance of Children. Is that what it's called?
Childhood.
Childhood, yeah. And in there, he's got a... Now, he's not Christian, is what I've picked up now through the readings. He never says he isn't explicitly, but he talks about Christians as an other often enough. And he talks about Luther, and he talks about the Reformation as actually the point in history where what we understand as children today was created. And it was created by education and by literacy and by creating a border between children and adults, where education becomes this space where you actually create a different class of citizen called the child in order to protect them from the adult world for the sake of learning so that they become a particular type of an adult, which is
interesting.
An educated, yeah, informed, a critically thinking adult. And that before that, in the ancient world, and he gave plenty of examples, and that all information was privy to all people, even the smallest of children, because it's a completely verbal society. You don't, and a society, say, like, where even physical human acts are just, they're just not secret until you want to protect that class of people for creating them as something.
It's true, even in the Roman Republican Empire, I wonder.
He made the claim that it was, but that he used some like ancient Greek sources. Maybe there were periods of history where that wasn't true. But the modern school,
I would think even in Rome, it could be very true for sort of the underclasses, and maybe not even.
Oh, he did give Cicero as an example of why, and it had to do with that what we have as gymnasium school only came into existence during the Reformation.
Oh, that's absolutely true. But I'm thinking the upper class, like nobility, were educated.
Yeah. Schools of sorts, but just for the. And I don't know the figures anymore, but. In ancient Rome, up to the time of the Reformation, the literacy rate, I mean, it's single digits.
Oh, it's like six. Oh,
yeah, it's really low, because there was no need to read.
Right. That was my larger point, is that you're the world that you experience as the world now is here because of the Reformation. This is not just a theological thing that happens. Politics are changed through this. The power that the church has politically has changed through this. The power of the individual to get educated, to be educated, and then to make independent decisions about X, Y, or Z that aren't arbitrary anymore, like even what they want to do with their life and down. Whole education systems started during the Reformation, from little wee babs all the way through the university system. The university system as we experience it in the United States, I've often argued, is much more modeled off of Melanchthon's, sort of university reforms in Germany than it is anything in the UK, where our sort of, even though, people that came over here from the UK probably started places like Harvard and stuff, stuff like that. What we do is much more based on a German educational system, university system as started by Melanchthon, as is sort of our younger grade school education on the gymnasium. Not one-to-one at all, but still different than even somewhere like the UK and how they did it and do it. Vocation is huge. Well,
and I'm no gender studies kind of guy, but, for the first time, Luther's advocating for young girls to be educated. That's kind of significant.
Yeah.
Talk about a move towards a more...
likely based on how smart his wife was from her sort of just initial education, from being a nun and then having daughters.
Well, that, and I think like the vocational thing that that rings true sort of has demands from your neighbor. I think somebody like Luther could realize that educated women, at least to an extent, are better equipped to, you know, answer the calls of the people in their lives who need them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's interesting. And I think because of that, it's an era with an explosion of questions, right? Like every question, every serious question, I'm not saying like, what do you want to eat today? But every serious question you've had about politics, about religion, about philosophy was probably asked in the Reformation. And the reason it's in your conscience as osmosis is because of this explosion of very big questions during that period of time.
Yeah, and like Adam said in the beginning, you can attribute some of that to the Renaissance too. But I think the Renaissance didn't even, like the Southern Renaissance didn't even create an educational system like the Reformation did. Back to Luther, it's kind of interesting. He, you know, we're all seen as very, you know, troglodyte type people.
Who's we? You two?
You specifically. Luther, think about how odd this would have been in his time, right? He marries off a bunch of nuns that come out of the nunnery because they have no other, they would be destitute otherwise, mm-hmm. right? They had no way of taking care of themselves. But he labors over every marriage. He labors over it, wants to make sure it's a good fit, makes sure she's going to be protected, taken care of, have a chance to contribute.
He's not trying to marry him off to some bum.
No, he labors over every single one. He says, you know, that young girls should be educated. His wife, his own wife, Katie, runs their house, runs their multiple businesses, starts multiple businesses, collects all the rents from all the students that live in the Blackfriars, maintains a staff that serves all these students, creates her own wealth, manages the money for the entire household. Luther defers to her on all of, and he says this, defers to her on all of these things. That is, you know, if you kind of think of like the, toxic masculinity of the past, this is not Luther in this situation. And that likely was rare for his time. Now, this could be Melanchthon kind of had the same thing going, except for his wife didn't do as good a job of it. And maybe these guys were just like classic academics, you know, like the bumbling professor who can't do anything but teach.
Yeah, I've met a couple of academics whose wives have to follow them to make sure the house isn't falling apart.
Yeah.
You're looking at me.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I mean, what I used to know about Rachel is she had a lot of stake in her house. A lot of order.
There's a lot of silence coming from this
corner.
She's a person of order.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that's interesting. The one of the other things I think you can't sort of really get past is the effect of translating the Bible into German, the language of the people. I mean, this really changes... you know, now even for sort of like the eternal questions, you don't have to go to a higher authority to get the answer other than the higher authority of Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
You can do this. And so people are now not only getting educated, but they have the Scriptures in their own language and they're able to adjudicate these bigger questions on their own. And this definitely leads to sort of the fragmented denominations of our day.
Mm-hmm. This might be a bit of a stretch, but the book is called The Return of the God Hypothesis. Now, I can't remember the author's name. Stephen Meyer. He quotes the father of modern chemistry, who's about a century after Luther, Robert Boyle, who talks about how science, he's describing how science has changed in his day and age. So that would be 17th century. And he says that science doesn't ask what must be, but rather what is. Rather than a priori approach to science, it's more a posteriori. That's preceded by Luther and the approach to Scripture. So you think of scholastics in the Middle Ages who are all like deducing and building systems and so on. And not that systems are bad necessarily, but it's an a priori approach to theology, whereas Luther turns that all on its head. Well, not just Luther, but turns it on its head and says very explicitly, theology is not about what God must be like, but what God has done.
Yeah, what he's and who revealed. God says he is.
Yeah, so
well, that's what sort he's of, done specifically.
Yeah, and so a more, and this is probably more broader kind of worldview kind of thing, but there's more, much more inductive thinking now rather than deductive thinking. I think you can argue that in the Reformation.
I think you can too.
And I do think that's more Reformation than it is Renaissance.
I agree with that too.
I think it's also something you have to continually fight for and like revisit, sure. Right? I like, it seems like this is, you know, going back to the, even the Postman thing, it seems like the world and culture is always trying to go back to making singular points of authority, getting rid of deductive thinking and just sort of, you know, trusting in various priests. We've replaced your local priest with various other types of priests with whatever they say, never to be verified or critically analyzed.
Yeah.
I have a question for you, Adam.
Okay. I was going to make a flat earth point, but I guess.
Go for it.
It was Copernicus, 1543, who publishes the On the Revolution of the Heavenly Sphere, so cosmological thinking is starting to take off, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to further reinforce.
I mean, later gets denied in the 2020s by people like Caleb, but sure.
Yeah. What's your question?
Do you think there's a northern renaissance that stands apart from the Reformation? In other words, is there an independent renaissance in the northern part of the Holy Roman Empire that's not just sort of subsumed into the Reformation? I know in the south, I think you can make an argument that there is.
Yeah, I think in the north, there, if we're defining the Reformation as something broader than just, say, the Lutheran Reformation,
sure,
I think they're one and the same.
Okay.
And I think the northern renaissance or humanism, whatever you want to call it, that's sort of a, maybe even a necessary precondition for the Reformation.
So that was my point, is that I think there's a pre-existing sort of northern humanism that turns into the Reformation, or northern renaissance that turns into the Reformation. But unlike in sort of the south and sort of in Italy and whatnot, it doesn't just kind of go independent of the Reformation at any, or the Reformation doesn't go independent of it, or the other way around.
Right. Yeah.
Southern
Renaissance, Italian Renaissance is very different. And I mean,
it's on its own for a long time, right? Because the Reformation down there is honestly in large part responding to what's happening in the north. Right?
I think.
Yeah.
You'd have to say it again because
the Renaissance, the Southern Renaissance, stays independent for so long from its Reformation, because the Southern Reformation, so to speak, or the Catholic Reformation, so to speak, is a response to what's happening in Northern Europe.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To me, the Renaissance north of the Alps is a totally different thing than what's going on. I mean, there's obviously that it's sparked by what goes down in Italy, but it's a totally different thing. It's much more practical. It's much more oriented. I mean, we all know the slogan that it's, you know, guided by this principle of ad fontes, going back to the sources, whether it's history or, you know, theology or anything in between. But it really is ordered around, it is part and parcel of theological training in the universities in the north. In Italy, you've got like Platonic academies beginning to emerge, where they're just doing their little quirky thing independent of everything else.
Right. It's in artistic, in architectural.
If you look at like a lot of those Dutch painters, Holbein and others, a lot of the stuff they're doing is very horizontal, very sort of anthropocentric, I guess, or
vocational even.
Yeah, but it's not. There, it's very practical or very realistic.
Farm scenes, people carrying fruit and water and milking cows and stuff like that.
Go down south. A lot of it's liturgical kind of art, but a lot of it's like not a glorification, but a return to antiquity and sort of not championing it, but highlighting the pagan past and so on, whereas in the north you don't have that nearly as much.
I think it also teaches you that some of this is like an accident. Like a lot of times when we want to change our culture, you know, I think we can set up, we'll look at the past, we'll look at history, and maybe we can repeat some of those firecracker moments, those like those moments that cause a reformation or that cause a revolution in order to get things going. But think about like how much of an accident it was that some of the individuals who are so significant, and without them, the our original thought experiment, the Reformation might not exist, right? Like a Luther who doesn't become extremely, you know, well-read in Latin and Hebrew, and then runs into this young guy whose uncle, named Melanchthon, whose uncle, like, insisted he become a master of Greek by the time he's 12, right? Like, what if Melanchthon's uncle dies before that education happens? Does the Reformation happen as we know it because some punk became a master of Greek at 12, right? Like, that's, you know,
sort of like
providential.
It's providential, yeah. It's,
it, I mean, and there's other fact. There's no way you can recreate it, right?
Right.
I mean, because it you just can't recreate history. I mean, you could try to and reenact things.
You have it's phenomenal that you have like larger than life figures, you know, that are to this day whose names you still know from this very brief period of time. Literally, if you go one more generation in theology, you don't know the names. Like, you might know the names. I might know some of the names. But if you're just to ask people, they don't know the names, mm-hmm. right? In this generation, you have Luther, the names that people would certainly know, Luther, Calvin, and Erasmus, right?
Yeah.
We've heard those names. They might not have heard Melanchthon. They should have. But they will have heard Luther. They would have heard Calvin. They would have heard Erasmus.
Yeah.
Go another generation. Theodore Beza, who's that, right? Martin Chemnitz, who's that? Go a generation past that. I mean, there is, and Caleb mentioned Reuchlin, right? Mm-hmm. Zwingli, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, you have these figures. They're literally larger than life figures. I mean, Zwingli died on the field of freaking battle.
Yeah, I mean, Zwingli is like...
In the 1500s.
Yeah, he went out swinging, dude.
After the... What was the Affair of the Sausages or whatever? What a weird name for... A lot of that, though, is the result of what historians have chosen, and I don't... And not arbitrarily, but what they've chosen to...
Highlight.
Preserve or highlight. Because... Now, there are people who are, you want, this is a whole the whole thing that historians are looking to do is like look back in the past and see what historians have missed. So it's entirely possible that some of these figures, Martin Chemnitz, to you and I, he's hugely significant, right?
Well, yeah. Sure.
He might even be more significant.
But I would say he's theologically, but he's not, not culturally.
True. Yeah. But what about Copernicus?
Right. Yeah.
People know the name, maybe, but a lot of it's...
they'll say the Copernican Revolution without knowing what they're referring to.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to say Luther's not hugely significant. He certainly was, but, I mean, it is kind of weird how we remember the past by, like, what historians would call the great man sort of approach, like, where you just highlight some certain figures.
I'm into that.
All sorts of other things get lost. Yeah. I am, too, but it's... And it's useful for remembering history and knowing what are the main things. But if that becomes the story,
there were some great men, and there were periods without them.
Sure.
I guess so. Think about it this way: you can take Luther and you can say everybody knows his name, and they maybe know his name because historians chose to
civil rights
highlight. Well, geez, highlight what he did, right?
Yeah.
But how could you have any other choice as a historian but to highlight what Luther did?
True. Well,
are you going to just pass it by?
What you'll do is sort of what the latest trend in history is to give equal time
to the little guy.
The little guy for
I've heard
history
this.
From below approach.
Yeah,
and there's a reason to do that. I'm not. You're looking at me with disdain.
I am.
The reason why they're doing that, best case scenario, is they're just trying to make sure that.
If you go to
clarify
like
the record, but there are, it's a very much a Marxist approach to history.
Okay, so this is my point. Who would you point at among the 17th century Lutherans that you would say deserved on the merits, not just theologically, not just in-house Lutheran informationally, but culturally broader importance to the entire world of history, who are you going to focus on?
When?
17th century. Century.
I'm trying to think.
It's going to be like Quinstead.
Yeah. No.
No, that's my point.
It's a fair point. Yeah, it takes you a minute. I've seen what you're talking about, Adam. If you go to like a historical museum right now, they'll do a lot of like, let's say there's an exhibit on Rome.
Everyday life in Rome will be slaves and women.
They don't want to just show you like, you know, what Roman rulers were doing or what the Senate was doing or whatever. They want you to know that this is what the everyday person was, in highlighting that to in some way that everyday person changed things as much as the big players.
Okay, well,
saying I agree. I'm just saying I've seen the trend.
That's a fine thing to do. I actually think that's a fine thing to do. A day in the life of a shoemaker in Wittenberg in 1546, the year Luther died. That's a great thing to do, right? It gives you perspective.
There actually were no shoemakers in Wittenberg in 1546. Just kidding. I just made that.
If you knew that,
if you knew that, you had to go to a cobbler outside of town, I was legitimately impressed. Yeah. Wow.
That's the great thing about being a historian. You can pretend to know crap more than you.
Well, every time I started a lecture where I'm going to do a bunch of history, I start it with, are there any actual historians in the room? If the answer is no, I'm like, good. Okay, let's go.
I'm that way with science. Scientists here. Let me tell you about DNA. It kind of spins. There's two helixes.
No, but I forgot what I was saying, but it was going to be good.
No, it's like...
So I was, like Caleb said, I was just describing it.
That was a fine thing to do, right? Yeah. Shoemaker, 16th century, 1546 in Wittenberg. That's great. But how do you straight-faced make an argument and then end your story of the shoemaker in Wittenberg in 1546 with, and he changed the world just as much as Martin Luther?
Yeah, that'd be foolish.
Yeah.
So there's a reason why there's this great man approach to history. There are great men.
And women.
Trying to think of some. No, I'm just kidding. You're going to have to edit that out, probably. I was totally kidding. But I was just saying what Scott was thinking.
Wow.
And Caleb's still thinking about how he can prove to us that Earth is flat.
Oh, my gosh. I love Copernicus. Copernicus is my homeboy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Except for when he's not. Okay. So, yeah. That's one thing. I think we can't look past And Adam touched on vocation, but really, you know, if you have no sense of the theological implications of the Reformation, you could care about the Reformation because, you know, the Reformation brought meaning to your everyday work if you're not a priest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm going to add something to that. And it really does, and I don't mean this to sound like a cliche, but it does open up the world. The medieval world is a very closed system. Luther and other great men like him,
Erasmus,
pushed the boundaries even further.
Yeah. Are you with me that we give too little credit to Erasmus?
Absolutely.
Well, culturally, we don't, though. Like, I think histories do a pretty good job. I think Lutherans don't because we know he's an enemy. But, like, in the cultures.
I'm going to say he was.
Can he be a frenemy?
That's perfect. I didn't even have that. I don't know that word because I'm not like you, but...
You do too. You have a teenage daughter. Don't lie to me.
Erasmus was no dummy.
That's right.
Obviously a very gifted thinker.
Erasmus changed the world in significant ways.
And his, like, what was it, In Praise of Folly?
Yes.
That's a masterful critique of the folly of some scholasticism.
Right.
Lutheran Reformation... We can be honest, doesn't occur without Erasmus.
Amen. Yes. Critical edition of the Greek New Testament.
Not just as the poking stick for Luther, right? Like, but that Greek New Testament. In fact, we could say something like the harshness that Luther treats him with has to do with the heartbreak that the guy who in part sets the world on fire doesn't seem to be going
the set the world on fire in more than one place. Praise of Folly sets the world on fire. He in a lot of ways leads the way for rocking the boat with Roman Catholic authorities over theological issues. I mean, we're, you know, some dude named Jan Hus tried this 95 years prior to Luther, and, you know, no one had been poking the bear that much, and so they just burned him. We're like, oh, we know how to take care of this. Stake, ground, firewood, match, boom, you know.
God, that's horrible.
But Erasmus and Reuchlin and other humanists like them, but I'd say particularly Erasmus. Reuchlin does it on the study of Hebrew and Old Testament side in much the same way that Erasmus does on the study of Greek in the New Testament side.
This is where maybe one of those people history's missed. I bet nobody
he's,
knows.
He's a little bit of more of an unsung hero on this. He doesn't publish as widely as Erasmus does, and he doesn't like do the work of putting together a critical edition of the Hebrew Old Testament or anything like that.
Got to wait for the Masoretic text to show up.
But Erasmus is critical to the Lutheran Reformation and thus the Reformation, because you don't have other reformations without the Lutheran Reformation, I don't think. I said that quietly in case Adam wanted to correct me.
No.
Okay. I mean, so we're close to time.
Well, I'm just going to say there's no Reformation also with another great man, with air quotes, Suleiman. Suleiman the Great.
Oh, no.
Out of Istanbul. Yeah, amen. And the marching of the Turks into Europe, scaring the socks. Wow. I think they wore socks. Yeah. I don't even know, but scaring both emperor and pope. Yes. Such that they didn't deal with Luther the way they dealt with Jan Hus. Right.
You're one. Because
I mean, it's a huge distraction. And for
20 years, 26 years.
Yeah, and the Lutheran princes will use that they know the emperor and the pope need northern German troops, so they'll use that to gain concessions for the legality of Lutheranism or the Lutheran confession.
Wow.
I know you can, right? Somebody could, but it's difficult to not see this time as absolutely providential.
Yeah, I mean, look at how many pieces had to fall in line.
Yeah.
One of these guys doesn't show up, whether it's a Turk at the border, you know, a Catholic humanist.
A Pope riddled with controversy and conflict.
Yeah. You know,
an angry
German mom
starts collecting indulgences in Luther's town.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, it's incredible. Yeah, so why should you care about the Reformation? I think we did a pretty good job summing it up. I mean, I would assume most of the people, not everybody who listens to this, has a white collar job. That's turns out what jobs in America are mostly like ours, and if you have that job, it only exists because of the Reformation. So it's probably worth
And if you have like I said, if you had any job besides that of a priest that you believe adds value to the world and to your neighbor, you should say thank you to Martin Luther and the Reformation for handing the world the doctrine of vocation.
That's great. Awesome, guys, fun episode.
We should do the next one, why you should believe that the Reformation led to postmodernism.
And do like a negative case.
Ooh. I mean, I could make a case for that.
I could too.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to figure out a postmodernism episode. That would be good to do.
We could get Bruce Hiller on it.
Bruce Hillman.
Hillman. Dang it.
Your pastor's Bob Hiller.
I know. I have too many Hill names in my life. But he's the bomb
on the postmodernism.
Yeah. Like awesome. The older stuff or the Foucaultian newer stuff?
All of it, man.
All of it.
He's not married and he just has a dog and a library.
Those guys are smart.
Don't look like you want that life.
No, I was actually thinking. Never mind. I was going to talk about how prison wouldn't be so bad.
Yeah.
That's getting cut. You're so bad. Well, guys, thank you for listening to this episode of The Thinking Fellows and one more why you should. Of course, you can send a message to us through the website at 1517.org. If you have a topic suggestion for the Why You Should series, and if you would like to support the show, you can go to 1517.org/donate, or you can follow the first link in the show notes of every episode. We appreciate your time. We'll catch you next week. Bye.